You're listening to the official podcast of Asbury University, produced by students with God-honoring conversations that inform, edify, and encourage. This is Asbury. We explore culture and current topics through a Christian worldview, promoting a well-balanced life, and we empower our community to belong, become, and be set apart. I'm your host, Abby Laub. Welcome to This is Asbury.
Welcome to the podcast. I have got the 2025 Search Symposium speaker with me in the studio today, Dr. Philip Tallon. Welcome.
Hey, Abby. Glad to be here.
Tell listeners who you are.
Well, I'm a dad. I'm a husband. I'm a Houstonian.
Right.
And I am the dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Christian University. And that's a lot of fun. It keeps me on my toes. And I'm also a graduate of Asbury Seminary, so I lived in Wilmore for a number of years,
hey.
Just down the road in a little farmhouse off Jessamine Station, so it's very nice to be back.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written some books, but most recently I gave a talk in chapel.
You did. It was excellent. Well, I have two questions for you. Did you watch the game last night?
I was at a fancy dinner, and so, but I... It was heartbreaking for Houstonians that, and so I guess maybe better that I missed it.
Right. And my next question is, how long ago were you here last, and has Wilmore changed at all since then?
The last time I was in town was just right after the outpouring.
Oh, great.
The Wesleyan Theological Society met at the seminary. And so I came up and, you know, of course was kind of just excited to hear stories and that sort of thing. And I've probably come back through every 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
Wilmore has not changed very much, to be honest.
Right.
There's some lovely additions to the college. I used to teach here a little bit, and so it's nice to see some new buildings pop up. But I'm happy to see that Wilmore's retained a little bit of its small-town charm.
Yeah, right? It's great. I mean, it definitely is what people love about it. It's very steady and unchanging, which, you know, we need some of that around here in the world.
Exactly.
And, you know, that sort of lends itself as a nice transition to your book, you know, these big old boring truths. A lot of unchanging truths of the faith. But I just want to kick off, you know, you talked in chapel with our students and you shared this wonderful analogy to start your talk about a fox and a hedgehog. Will you share with listeners who's the fox and who's the hedgehog? It was such a good analogy.
Neither are friends of mine. I'm not telling stories at a school. They're two mythical creatures from an old Greek poet used to make an example or legendary example. And the fox and the hedgehog both represent different sort of ways of being in the world. And so Archilochus is the old poet, and he has this line where he says, "The fox knows many things. The hedgehog knows one big thing." Perhaps related to the temperaments of foxes and hedgehogs. Fox will run around. Sniff around, kind of very active. The hedgehog doesn't move around as much, but it's kind of got its plan figured out. It's got a spiky exterior. People don't mess with it, and it can just go around eating bugs. And the idea, I think most famously, was picked up by a philosopher named Isaiah Berlin, and he talked about different thinkers throughout history as either foxes or hedgehogs, right? So either people who are concerned about a whole, you know, a bunch of different things, somebody who kind of had one big idea that they were continually focused on. And it's not a judgment necessarily, but I liked the contrast, and I thought it might be helpful to make a point about what I think is a useful first step for folks, especially when it comes to understanding Christian theology, which is to be like the hedgehog and sort of focus on one big truth and get that in your mind first before you then run around and explore many other things. And because I think there's a tendency right now to, there are so many interesting kind of curious things that we often want to go out and explore before we've really got kind of a good solid sense of what's most real, what's most true, what's most important.
Yeah, I love that. Well, and I think the students took that to heart. It seemed like they were really locked in with you. So what are the key you called them big, old, boring truths. What's the hedgehog locked in on?
Well, I suppose, depending on who you ask, they would have different large hedgehog-like big, old, boring truths. But for me, and a lot of my work has focused on this, it's really about teaching well the core deposit of the Christian faith, things Christians always and everywhere have believed. And so really thinking about Christian doctrine, right? So what are the big points about who God is, God's work of redemption in the world? What does salvation look like? What's our purpose? How do Christians belong and behave? And that's a big topic, of course, but there are some guides that help to winnow that down really to some essentials. And so you find various denominations have like a set of church doctrine, or sometimes they have like a catechesis. These are the questions and answers that you can go through. And of course, there are things like the creeds, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, that's the whole church coming together and saying, this is our big old truth that we think is important that everybody understands. And so I want to hold that up, and I think that's really valuable. And I enjoy when I talk to somebody who believes very different than me,
mm-hmm.
if I ask them, okay, so what are you really all about? If they can explain it.
Mm-hmm.
And I worry sometimes that as we encounter folks, they want to say, what does it really mean to be a Christian? What do Christians right. believe? We start strong and then kind of trail off. And
right.
and then, actually, I don't really 100%. I think I talked about that in theology class. But so I want people to have that really good grounded sense of mm-hmm. what is most important.
Yeah.
And the good news is, though, that it's not really a competition between being a fox and a hedgehog, which is to say that, and the whole idea of a Christian university is that you have all, you've got them both living together in one happy zoo where, you still understand big, important truths, but then you're able to explore all the different ways that humans can understand, study the world, make new things, discover new truths. And that's beautiful.
Yeah. Well, and there's hardly a better place to learn that than at a Christian institution, but you also shared that Christian higher education and the churches really are also not immune to this. So how did we get here? How did we get to that point where even a lot of churches or Christian colleges, maybe they have to sort through their big old boring truths?
I think you sometimes see in curriculum, of course, not at fine schools like Asbury
of course
or
not.
Houston Christian University.
Exactly.
But that they do buffet style, sort of like choose, create your own curriculum and don't have a sort of solid core of this is really what you need in order to be an mm-hmm. educated person in this liberal arts tradition. And so, I would want to push back against that. We want to really make sure that we've got core
stuff. Even those practices like chapels, I'm sure Houston Christian has those, just 3 times a week you have to go and hear the Bible being mm-hmm. taught. So stuff like that, I think, just goes such a long way.
So pushing back against a kind of choose your own adventure, a picture of education toward a more formational experience.
Right.
Right. You go into boot camp and in the Army, they don't let you kind of decide, okay, all the things that you're going to focus on. No, you have to all do the same thing. And there's a place for that as a part of the educational experience. Then, of course, you branch out and specialize. So it's not an either or. But practically speaking, I think that everybody is dealing with an incredible amount of distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a crisis of knowing which voices are really worth listening to. An educational crisis of much earlier ages might have been limited access to helpful information. Now I think we suffer from the opposite, which is an overabundance of information.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even know who to trust. And a lot of it is very contradictory.
Yeah.
So having to sort out who to listen to is important. And that's where I think that good, settled, old classic wisdom is useful to have as a foundation.
Yeah.
And then that can help you to evaluate which are good voices to pay attention to.
Oh, yeah. Because, think about it. If you're 16 and perhaps you didn't grow up with Christian parents and, you're a baby Christian, and where are you going to go to learn these things? Like, are you going to go to TikTok? Sadly, probably yes for a lot of kids. And just like you said, without that kind of, you know, classical, you know, settled, you know, like this is what we believe. It's hard to know where to go, I would imagine, without that foundation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the, you know, of course, in scriptural terms, there's this, within the Bible itself, we have these wisdom sayings. And, you know, what wisdom is, you know, this is guidance that will help you most of the time to make the right decision in most situations. And it's not a complete account of what you should do in every particular situation, but it's still going to steer you in that right direction. And so we want to have this wisdom in us that then helps to direct us toward the truth most of the time.
Yeah.
And then we grow in knowledge and we gain understanding.
Yeah. Well, there's so much, you know, there's so many things where, of course, none of us are perfect, even if we've been a Christian for a long time and, you know, we were fortunate to grow up in a Christian home and a great church, but there's still this bombardment of information. You said we remain uneducated in an ocean of information. And there's so much of that no matter how solid you are, you know, I have found myself recently going down a few rabbit holes and I'm like, oh, but should I even be wasting my time with this? Is this even true? Oh, you know, there's always some carrot dangling in front of us. Is there anything that you have you found yourself getting distracted by in this age of bombardment of information?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love reading, you know, popular books that explain ideas that are outside my area, and very often those books kind of point out, oh, the, you know, the common everyday understanding of this is wrong. And so then I read a book and I feel really smart because I understand what the sophisticated take is, but I still don't have any kind of decent sense of actually what the field might be. And so if I'm at a party, I might be able to say one clever thing on any given topic, but the second somebody actually follows up and asks,
you're like,
ask a further question, I have to say, oh, I really don't know anything much at all. And we all do this. So this is part of going through life. Of course, I adore people who are really comfortable in just saying, oh, actually, I don't know what you mean there. To say a bit more. Mm-hmm. I want to learn. And I actually do have this. They don't just want to sound smart. They actually want to be smart.
Right. Right. You know, how old are your kids? Are they young?
They're all the ages. They're all the ages you can be. I've got one in elementary school, one in middle school, one in high school, and one in college.
So it's hard because, you know, as parents, I've got children myself, you know, how do we help them navigate this ocean of information just on a very practical level? I mean, we can all talk about like, oh, the phones and all these things, but how do you practically do that to where they still like you afterward, you know?
It's a great question. I'm still figuring it out because we do have some of these issues come up. So, you know, kids wanting to think about, oh, I want to be on a really healthy diet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then they go on YouTube and come back with
right.
what they've heard. And you, okay, well, you know,
think about this a little bit.
Yeah, let's talk about this a little bit more because what you're doing is not going to be sustainable or it's actually not healthy. I mean, for the most part, the rule of thumb that I keep in mind is that our kids will listen to some of what you say, but they'll always watch what you do.
Yes.
And
there
so,
you go.
And so if those two things are in conflict, know which one is going to win. And so I think, you know, so having a sort of a centered set approach, okay, what do I want to make sure that as I'm going through life, I'm focused on what the Bible says about me and what it means to live. And that then actively, as I make decisions, kind of process through that, they actually see this is a part of how I operate in the world, is that I want to hear what Scripture says and want to apply it in my life. And then that's probably going to do as much, you know, or more than telling them something that is true, but actually
you really have to
myself.
Model it. Absolutely. Yeah. And there's so many, you know, each stage of parenthood brings a new set of that, but absolutely definitely comes down to that. And I love the emphasis that you said, you talked about creeds and how they grow in beauty and depth. I love that. Can you just share a little bit more about that. And you talk to the students about this, but they're not boring. You know, the kid at face value maybe feel a little boring, but they're not. Talk about why this is so important.
The boring part of the big old boring truths was a little bit of a mislead in a certain way, which is to say that I think these things are important even if they don't excite you every moment. And we can't have that be our standard. But I think it's the case with a lot of learning that the more deeply you understand something, the more you really mm-hmm. enjoy thinking about it and take delight in it. But it's especially true when it comes to these fundamental issues of Christian theology. And so the initial step of working to get down the language mm-hmm. of the Trinity, for instance, mm. three persons and one God, okay, the differentiation of the persons, they share a substance, isn't the most exciting thing mm-hmm. you can work on. But then once you've got that down, you can return to it and kind of process things through it. But then I think you come to see more as you grow older and reflect on it. Oh, okay. So there's a way that relationality, the unity through relationality, can actually get as close as possible. Like we can be as unified as possible to other people while still, retaining some measure of distinctness. That's a really valuable insight. It's not a competitive thing. Okay, I need space from you in order to be myself. And we're dealing with, and especially when we're dealing with God, that within God there's room for personality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for us too. So as we grow closer to God, that's not going to remove our own distinct, the true us, right? The true us that God knows is the true us. We don't always know what that is. And I think if you can only get to those insights if you've already worked through some of the basics first. And what I just said there could be applied again and again to many other teachings of Christian theology that you come to see more, you realize more, more deeply. And so it's like a really good book that when you reread it, I see more this time than I saw the last time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the first time I read it, I wasn't as crazy about it. But then when I came back to it, I saw so much more. And that's, I think, how it is with a lot of truth is that it grows with you and repays further attention.
Yeah. Well, and then even just this idea that we're sort of, tied together throughout history with these same truths. I think you said maybe it was 1,400 years old, the Nicene Creed. Is that
the Nicene Creed? 1,700 years old
okay.
this year.
So just thinking about that fact alone is really pretty cool. this is what Christians have been espousing for all these years. This truth, I think, is a pretty powerful thing to think about.
Makes you feel unified with our
exactly.
brothers and sisters from ages past.
Generations.
Maybe if you time traveled back 1,500 years, maybe when you walked into church, perhaps you wouldn't understand anything except some of the language.
Yeah.
You can kind of figure out, okay, I think this is
right.
the same
I
thing. We've
say
been saying this
too.
All the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really powerful. And now, so you teach students as well, college students at Houston Christian. You're the dean of School of Christian Thought. So surely you have come across these observations, with your own students, these big old boring truths and helping them understand. Are there certain things that you think Gen Z potentially is uniquely struggling with? Are there some certain truths that you're like, okay, I'm seeing a lot of this? Or,
well, there's a problem of hope. And it's very real.
Mm.
And so the statistics on suicide in America mm-hmm. are distressing.
Yeah.
Every 11 minutes or so, someone's committing suicide. Young people are struggling with mental health
mm-hmm.
for many reasons, but I think that an underlying problem is a sense of despair, of hopelessness.
Mm.
So, mild or more serious, maybe just a sense of America's declining economic prospects, or that there are fewer opportunities, standard of living going down, or just general unrest and
even
concern
just
about
knowing
that.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Even just knowing too much of what's going on in the world, you know, just think about the access that we have. I mean, talk about a lack of hope.
You can doom scroll and see all the stuff we know so much, and hope, you know, hope is not just ignorance of the problems. Hope is a deep, you know, sense of a future good that is coming toward us, and so that's the end of the Nicene Creed, is that the crucified king who defeated everything in his cross, he suffered as much as a person can suffer and was raised again. It's going to come back and set everything right. And so, and that's a story we can tell ourselves every week and really have, you know, be future minded and practice hopefulness. Mm-hmm. It's tough, but I think that at the very least, that's a good word that we can speak to a generation. But I need that word as well.
Mm-hmm.
I feel, you know, temptation to despair or worry, what's all this going to look like? Or even just for my, you know, for my kids.
Yeah.
What's going to happen here? Yeah. And so learning to hope, and then also being emboldened to take action, which is, I think, all the funny paradoxical truth about hope is that when you really firmly believe that there's reason to hope, it actually drives you to do things.
Yeah.
Here and now.
It requires you to take action ultimately. Yeah. Well, and then just, you know, having your hope in Christ, like that. That's easy to say, but again, what do you do with that? And then your other book, The Poetics of Evil. Tell me a little bit about that one and what that's about.
Thanks. That was my first book. It's a little pricey, but if people want to buy it, you know, it's worth every penny, all $100. It's a book that is about the problem of evil, right? The challenge that evil poses to our ability to speak about God's goodness and God's power, and then how to kind of make sense of that. And part of that making sense of that I focus on in the book is using the arts as a way of speaking about hope, but then also to help us see and understand the difficulty of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So artistic categories like tragedy or even horror can be ways of capturing something that's very real about evil, and then can illuminate the ways that God redeems and works even in the midst of those moments.
Yeah. Yeah, because you said, you know, from the argument of beauty, theology, and film, and C.S. Lewis. There's a lot of C.S. Lewis fans around here. I'm sure you've already picked up on that. But
normally I'm the biggest, but not around here.
Okay. In Houston, you are the biggest C.S. Lewis fan. Well, I think even just the problem of evil is itself one of these big, boring truths, I guess. Would that be one of your arguments?
Well, certainly understanding the human fallenness and that the line between good and evil runs through every human heart is fundamental. If we don't understand that about ourselves, then we're profoundly mistaken. And again, that shouldn't lead to despair, because it should lead us to repentance, regeneration,
and hope.
Christ, and hope. But if we don't have a sense of our own sinfulness, then we're going to be stuck with it. Well, that's a hedgehog that we'll keep blaming on a bunch of little foxes. Oh, I'm just tired, or you know, oh, I'm too busy, or I didn't really mean that. When in fact, there's this big truth about us, which is that we do have this sinful nature that we act out of. And so once you can own that and, you know, recognize it, hug the cactus, I've got sin, then you can really move on to dealing with it.
Yeah, definitely. So who are these books geared toward? Are you writing with an audience in mind?
All the ages, but not each book for all the ages. Mm-hmm. The Poetics of Evil is a academic manuscript, But I also wrote the Absolute Basics of the Christian Faith and the Absolute Basics of the Wesleyan Way with my friend Justice Hunter, and those are written to be accessible for anybody
or
used
got
in
these
churches.
Fun, like cartoon covers, I love those. Tell me about those. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just Google these books: the Absolute Basics of the Christian Faith and the Absolute Basics of the Wesleyan Way. They're super fun covers. I want to know your inspiration for those.
Well, yeah. So I mean, obviously, I wanted to basically just kind of get at some of the really big ideas but take time and add charm to help bring them home. And so I found an artist who's wonderful. His name is Andrew Chandler, and he illustrated videos, and he those illustrations then also went into the book. And we're trying to make Christian theology as accessible as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then also talk about Wesley's story and the movement and his key contributions in the other book.
Yeah. Well, you're speaking tonight at the Search Symposium. It's open to the public. It will be on the website if you're hearing this much later and you want to watch it. Just in closing, just share with me what you're going to talk about tonight.
Well, tonight I'm going to talk about the Christian imagination. And mm-hmm. specifically a feature of the Christian imagination, or the imagination in general, which is often called reenchantment. And so the Inklings describe this feature that when you read a fantasy story, that it can send you back with pleasure into the actual, right? That you come back and that you go into an enchanted wood, and then you go to see the woods near your neighborhood, and you find them a little bit enchanted. And so instead of finding real woods more dull, you actually find them exciting, because the arts can help us to kind of remind us about the beauty of the world, the primary world, the world as it is. And so I want to talk about this. I think this is a really important way that the arts work in my life. I get a lot out of seeing some basic truth, but seeing it in a fresh way. So that's kind of connected to my talk in about the big old boring truths, which is that we can get tired of talking about these big things. And so finding new ways to rediscover the wonder and the enjoyment is very important.
Yeah. Well, and what better place to do that than just going outside? I'm a big fan of that. And, you know, I love, like, if you think back of when your kids were really small, they would stop and just pick up a leaf or pick up a flower petal and just inspect it. And when you actually do that as an adult, and you just stop and think through all the complexities inside that one tiny little thing, it really is pretty remarkable. And it's humbling as well. And exciting and beautiful.
Absolutely. G.K. Chesterton, who's the grandfather of people like Tolkien and Lewis, and that he inspired a lot of their work. He says, you know, fairy tales reignite this original fire of wonder that we had as children.
Mm-hmm.
And so a fairy tale makes rivers run with wine to remind us of the moment when we discovered they ran with water, right? So that they remind us of that childlike joy that we have in perceiving this incredible, magical world that God has made.
Right. Well, in closing, just share a word of encouragement to our listeners, who many of them are parents, many of them are alumni or other professors like yourself. And you're in it now with your family and with students. Just a word for them of encouragement in closing.
These are the good old days.
Yes.
To be able to experience the present moment as if it will someday be a treasured memory, mm-hmm. even when it's difficult, is a powerful thing.
Yeah. And then, sorry, one more. I lied. I do love asking, you know, you talked about hope earlier being the thing that you most see lacking right now. And a lot of people talk about current students in this way that just feels like, oh, my gosh. And every generation does this. I'm a millennial. And I remember people were like boo-booing on millennials. And I'm like, come on, what? You know, so what are these beautiful characteristics that you see that are different and that do fill you with hope?
For the rising generation,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's interesting looking at generational studies. A lot of it, from time out of mind, people have been looking at the rising generation and saying, "Oh my goodness,
exactly."
Kids these days. Saint Augustine in his Confessions talks about having to teach students. He's like, I couldn't do anything with these kids. The students
are
terrible.
We all do it,
and you know, and that was in ancient Rome, and so likewise, perennially, you know, I think we often look to the next generation. I mean, I work with a lot of with a lot of young people. Mm-hmm. And I think that, we are, you know, we are very much alike. There's one feature that I have noticed is that there is an openness and a vulnerability to young people about the way they speak that I find really refreshing. Yeah. And admirable. Mm-hmm. Willing to admit, you know, their problems. Oh my goodness, I was talking to my therapist about this thing. Right. I'm just sharing it openly. It's right. Not a big deal. Something I would have a hard time sharing. Yes. I'm learning something yeah. from you about how transparent you can be. Sometimes that goes with some negative self-talk and some other and overwillingness to describe your temporary inability as being a deficiency. And so there's a kind of a flip side to that coin. But I do love the transparency and self-deprecation of young
yeah.
people.
I agree. That's a great place to close. Thank you again for your time, Dr. Talon, and we look forward to hearing you speak tonight. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of This is Asbury. To learn more about Asbury University, visit asbury.edu.